What's going on, guys, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Let's Just Talk podcast. I'm super excited to have this guy on. I think he's super, I guess, topical at the moment with the world going mad with interest rates, inflation, and everything like that. And I came across your content because of my wife, mate, so I can't take the credit that I was the one that found you. But I appreciate the content that you do put out since diving deep into what you do and everything that you have done since, you know, you're obviously got a business that you run in this kind of world. You've got a book, and I'd love to obviously talk to you all about those, but also talk more about, I guess, financial literacy. I know we've talked off camera before and said that I think health literacy and kind of wealth literacy kind of really go hand in hand. There's a lot of things that kind of really parallel between the two worlds. And so I think that we can have a fun chat. But with all of that said, Ben, welcome to the show, and I appreciate your time, mate.
Oh, mate, good to be here. And yeah, I agree that I think that there's a ton of crossover between health, well-being, money, success, basically anything that's hard and doesn't, you know, it's short-term work for a payoff that happens not in the short term. It's, you know, the habits, the tactics, the way that you approach it. So yeah, I'm keen to get into it.
I don't like giving my father too much credit in my life for things that I've done well, but I will kind of say, I can remember from a very early age, him just drilling into me the idea of compounding over time. And I still use that kind of premise with my own clients of it, you know, do those little things and do them consistently over time. And they really do add up. You don't know what that 5-minute walk today might actually lead to in 10 years time, if it then compounded over time and you become a runner or you get in, like all of those kinds of things. And I certainly took his financial advice with regards to compounding, and I did it too late. And you know, I say too late, like later than I probably would have. And he's sitting there going, well, if you'd been doing this, you know, kind of things. But I guess I'm guilty of, in the finance world or financial world, of trying to take the shortcut. I'm happily to put my hand up and say I've bought courses, I've gone to things thinking, oh, this guy has the hack and I'm going to be a millionaire next week if I do his 5-step guide to becoming a millionaire kind of thing. And I consider myself a pretty intelligent guy. And yet when it comes to kind of financial things like that, I will say, I've lost my mind and gone, no, this is the thing. And it's like, Amy, my wife, Ames, I think I've got it kind of thing. And she just rolls her eyes and I'm like, no, it's not, idiot. Just let's kind of get knuckled down. And I would say I'm a more prudent kind of person these days in that, no, just do the little things over time and grind it out and kind of do it over. But I say all of that to kind of say, watching your content, it's really like kind of rung a bell well to me and kind of really drilled in that, you know, there's those little things you just have to kind of do over time. But I kind of want to ask the question, where do most people go wrong with kind of, I guess, setting up a future for themselves that kind of does look free from having to stress all the time about wealth or security and kind of money?
Well, I think you probably touched on one of the points there, that looking for short term, you know, massive results in the short term. And there are no free rides when it comes to money. There's no quick fixes as well. And I think it's probably Facebook's fault or something that you see these stories online and social media and someone just got incredibly lucky, maybe with their timing or, you know, the stars have sort of aligned and it's meant that they've, you know, build a lot of investments or made a lot of money in a short amount of time. But that's the one in a million things. Now we tend to gravitate to that because it's a really nice story and an interesting thing to look at. But the reality is that it is one in a million. And most of the time, if you're going, you know, if you're betting on that happening, you're probably going to be betting the wrong way. So it's funny, I started working with a PT about 3 years ago and he asked me a question. I was surprised that no one had asked me this question before. He said, like, what's your top money tip? Like, what's the one thing? And it's, I thought about it for a second and I said, spend less than you earn. And it's sort of like for in his world, like we've been on this thing and I got way out of shape with COVID and, you know, stacked on a bunch of weight and got a bit slack. And for them, it's the same stuff. And it's like fitness and health, that there's no quick fixes there. Like, sure, there's tons of fads out there and you look at the amount of money that we waste on, you know, the latest trend around something, those things are they are only they might give some sort of impact in the short term, but the impact is going to be short-lived. And it's really the fundamentals and the basics that have the biggest impact, you know, over time. So I'd say when you set your expectations too high, or you think that you're going to start investing and then immediately shoot the lights out, what actually happens is you don't get those results in the time frame that you're expecting. And then you get frustrated and you get fed up and then you get distracted and then you don't follow it through, to your point, compounding, that it's just, you know, you're not going to make that much money this year. Like, you make a bit, sure, and that's going to be great. But it's really like, you know, the year after it gets a bit more, and the year after it gets a bit more. And it's like that double, double, double principle. Not that it double doubles, but, you know, it's the last year that you own any investment is where you get the biggest upside. So that just means if you start 1 year sooner, like this year, you're going to make a small amount, but it's that last year that you get the big payoff as well. And so I think that when you want to set your expectations in the right way, so that you know that that's the case, and then you can follow the bouncing ball and put in the work so that you can actually reap the benefits later on. So I'd say that that's a big thing. The other one is probably, and I get that this is a little bit boring and, you know, not that sexy, and apologies in advance to your listeners, but budgeting and how you actually run your money, like how you manage your money, how you save, how you prioritize with your money, that is the foundation for all investing. Like, it's hard to be a good investor, particularly when you're in that building phase of your wealth, if you're not clear on what your cash flow actually is. Like, how much money do you need to live and enjoy the lifestyle that you want today? And then how much do you have left over for saving and investing? And is that enough for you to make the like the progress that you want from a wealth building perspective as well? People tend to gloss over that, and they think that being successful with money is just about choosing good investments, and choosing good investments is important, but it's not enough. Yeah. And it's like, it's a small part of a big picture. Knowing, being really clear on what your budget is and how much money you've got to work with, that's the thing that will give you the confidence when it comes to making your next big investment, or knowing when the right time is to buy a property, or, you know, how quickly you can pay down your mortgage, or how much you should spend on your own home to begin with, and make sure that you can do that and pay it down and still build investments so that you've got financial assets that are actually growing for you. So I get that it's a little bit boring. Not many people other than me and my team get too excited, you know, crunching these numbers in spreadsheets, but it really is the foundation for everything else. So focusing on those things, I think does go a really long way.
The thing that I'm kind of seeing more and more these days is, I think Gary Vaynerchuk is probably a driving force behind this. And he's always spoken about that being an entrepreneur and kind of running a business and having that, in quote, side hustle and those kinds of things. If you kind of go back to like the 90s, if you said, oh, I run my own business, you were a bum. Like, it was like, oh, so you haven't gone out and got a job like everyone else has, kind of thing. But these days, having side hustles, getting a business, leaving the workforce, leaving the 9-to-5 behind, kind of thing, as an idea, it's kind of become a bit sexified online. Everyone's running a business these days. Everyone's got a side hustle these days. And then obviously these people online are then selling that idea of like, you can leave the workforce and kind of go and start that. Is that, what's the question I'm trying to ask? It's like, is that a reality though? And I ask that purely because the world still needs teachers. The world still needs doctors. The world still needs, and so we need people that are kind of still, I guess, running the infrastructure of the world so that these dreamers, for lack of a better word, can go off and start their businesses and their side hustles. And so I kind of lead in all of that again to say, is there a world in which every person can leave their kind of 9-to-5 to go and chase that dream of that, or has that dream kind of been implanted into us because we see it, you know, becoming the sexy thing to do at the moment?
Yeah. Look, I'm not sure if the world would function if everybody worked for themselves, but I'm not too sure how the government would run, for example, or the public service, or, you know, schools and hospitals and all that sort of stuff. But look, I would say that Yeah, it is absolutely. I agree that it seems like the sexy option, and there's with all of the plethora of information online that people are saying about how you can, you know, make all this money and not work that much. And look, I started my business in 2015. I never considered myself an entrepreneur. I've got a lot of mates, and now I know a lot of business owners, and I know a lot of them, and they always wanted to be entrepreneurs. They always wanted to be business owners. That was not me. I just wanted to work, and I didn't really want to have a boss. And I had a few things that I thought I could do a little bit differently, and I was excited by that. So I started my own business, but I don't have the stats at hand, but I know that it's something like some huge percentages of businesses fail, you know, in the first year or the first few years. And there's a very, very small percentage, I hear this through our business coach, very, very small percentage of businesses that earn, that generate revenue in excess of $1 million a year. It's something, it's sub 10%. I don't know what the actual number is, but I think what that means is that, like, yeah, it's possible. And I'm a business owner, so obviously I like it enough to keep doing it. And I do think that there is a financial opportunity if you're, you know, hardworking, you're smart with your approach, you like what you do with, you know, health and well-being and what you do with your money. You learn things, you build good habits around how you plan with your business, how you manage your business, how you grow your business. I think there's an opportunity there, but I also know that that is not for everyone. And I think if you, if it's not for you and you go down that path, you're potentially costing yourself a pretty significant amount, potentially in actual dollars, but definitely in lost income, lost earning potential, lost career growth potential as well. So I think if you, yeah, for the right people, sure. But if it's not you, I think you got to know your limitations and save yourself that time, frustration, stress, and maybe stick to something that's going to pay you a good salary. And I think that the thing is that, like, you don't need to earn an enormous income to get ahead with your wealth. Like, you obviously, the more income you earn, it can be helpful so long as you're putting it to actual good use. But I've worked with a whole range of people, from people that have very low incomes, well below the average income, to people that are earning like $1 million plus a year. And I've noticed that, like, these people are in a range of positions, and it's actually not how big someone's income is that dictates whether they're going to be doing well or poorly. It's generally the people that are doing better are the ones that put themselves in a position so that they can take action with their money sooner and invest money sooner specifically, and then build good habits and continue to improve what they're doing with their money over time. And I've seen people that are earning, you know, average-ish, like the median income in Australia is $92,000. Couple that's earning less than that, less than, you know, twice the average income combined, that save more money than someone that's making $500,000 a year. So, and are on a stronger trajectory financially than someone in that position. So I think it doesn't make, you don't want to ignore income for sure, but I think that there's a lot of people that can get more from what they've already got. It's like, maybe it's good, but it's not like a necessary thing to get ahead.
I'd love you to kind of, I guess, talk more on investing then, because I mean, I know I certainly was, and I've spoken to enough people in my life to kind of hear, you know, the scared tone in people's voice when it comes around investing, because, you know, we all work hard for our money and we don't want to kind of just see it all disappear because some company that you think, oh, this is going to be great, I'll start investing, or I'll go into the stock market, or I'll do this or do that, or whatever it might be. And that kind of fear that it's just going to all disappear. And so for people, I guess, listening at home, like, where do people start to try and limit, I guess, the scared undertones that people have, as I said, of just losing it all, because again, the world's always turbulent, it's volatile. You always hear those doom and glooms, like, oh, if I go and buy a house, oh, the whole, you know, housing market's going to crash tomorrow. Or I go and invest in the stock market, the whole stock market's going to crash tomorrow. I lose all my money. So, like, where do people kind of begin, or where would you suggest kind of people begin if, you know, they have taken your advice and they go, you know what, okay, I'm going to get started. I'm going to start using my money in a more kind of, you know, I guess, smarter way, for lack of a better word, to kind of send my trajectory better in the future, where should people kind of start?
Yeah, well, I think that people, with any sort of investment, you need to understand enough to have confidence in what you're doing. And to, I'll directly answer the question, but to answer a slightly different question, which is where people go wrong with investing, is like they sell investments at the wrong time. And people do that because they're scared, they're worried, and they act in a reactive way. Now, when you understand the share market, and not to say that you need to understand, you know, Markowitz portfolio theory or like the ins and in depth sort of personal finance or finance sort of rules and regulations and that sort of stuff, but knowing enough about what you're investing into goes a long way to giving you that confidence. Similarly with property markets and what drives values there is important. But look, obviously, you know, maybe I should have said this at the start, but none of this is financial advice. But I think, like, I use index funds. We use these heavily with our clients. What an index fund does is it buys a small amount of every single company that's listed on the stock exchange. They're really easy to access. There's tons of them out there. And they give you exactly what the share market does. So where, like, when you invest in one single company, so you buy one share on the stock exchange, what you're doing is you're putting money into a company, and if that company does well, you're going to make money. If it does poorly, then you're not going to make as much money, or you're potentially going to lose money. When you buy an index fund that buys a bit of every single company that's in the share market, the only way that investment can go to zero is if every single company in the country goes bust at the same time. And if that happens, you've got bigger problems in your investment portfolio, right? We're talking about zombie apocalypse, nuclear winter, something like that. Like, it's the end of capitalism is what we're talking about, essentially. So for mine, I go, well, an investment like that, you know that, you know, in COVID, an index fund would have gone down by 40%. In the GFC, it would have been around the same amount. Like, when there's a serious market downturn, sure, yeah, it's going to go down by 40-ish percent because that's what happens. But you know that good companies will continue to make money, and then therefore your investments will recover over time. So I think that can be a good way to, you know, have that peace of mind. And that this all sounds good, and you go, well, what's the catch? But the thing is that index funds are super cheap, and the stats show that they perform better more than 80% of the time, because the alternative is what's called an actively managed fund, where you've got some fund manager or research house or investment company, and they're picking particular stocks. They're saying, we think these companies are going to do better, we think these companies are going to do worse, and then we'll put more of these ones and put less of those ones in. Now, no one knows the future. We don't have a crystal ball. So when you're going down that path, maybe they get it right, maybe they get it wrong, but the statistics show that they get it wrong more than 80% of the time compared to what an index fund does. So it performs better, it's cheaper, and gives you more peace of mind. And then long-term return on the Australian share market is 9.8%. In the US, it's a bit over 10%. That's enough. If you put that into a compound interest calculator, I use the Money Smart one run by the government, really easy to use and navigate. You put in a 10% return and investing, you know, I think $117 a week will make you a millionaire in 30 years. For a 20-year-old investing $10 a day, it's like $2 million by age 60. Like, these are small amounts compounding over time, deliver you rock solid outcomes. So I get that the fear, no one wants to do the dumb thing that ends up costing them a bunch of money. And that's what paralyzes people from taking action. But reality is that when you don't act with your money, all you're doing is you're crystallizing an opportunity cost that you can never recover from, because a month goes past, 6 months, a year, and you're in the same position. And it's all too, like, there's so much information out there. It's like, you don't know what to do. Worried about making a mistake, too hard basket, end up doing nothing, time rolls on. And what you've missed out on is not just the investing the money, but if you would have invested the money today, you would have got some growth over the next year. That then gets reinvested for the next year and the next year and the next year and the next 30 or 50 years beyond that. So that's where the opportunity costs. It's not just how much extra you won't have in 12 months. It's then how much extra that amount would actually grow to for you over the next 30 years.
The thing that comes to mind when you say that is that, and I'd love just your 2 cents on the topic of kind of talking about COVID, where the government said people could dip into their superannuation, take out some money now to obviously help out pay the bills from now. And I guess on the surface, that sounds great. Like, you know, people lost their jobs and things obviously went south there. And so I need that 10 grand to get me through the next couple of months to hopefully, talk about that opportunity cost that, 10 grand taken out of now. Sure, you're not going to see a whole lot of loss out of your super, but how that compounds over time of what that 10 grand will actually cost you in 30 years time when you retire. I say all that again, like, do you think that was a good idea for, I mean, again, it's 6 1/2 dozen, like, what do people do in that situation? But like, what were your thoughts on that kind of whole time with then people dipping into their superannuation?
Well, I thought it was a crazy policy, like, helpful, sure. For people that were struggling, definitely. But the people that were probably struggling the most, they're the ones that were probably not going to be on as strong a path with their super growth moving forward as well. So they're the ones that are going to need the super in the future. And raiding, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 out of your super if you're in your 20s or 30s or 40s, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars by the time you reach retirement age. So, yeah, I get you've got to make ends meet, but stealing from your future self is probably not the best idea to do that.
I know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad? What's his name? Robert Kiyosaki? Is that?
Kiyosaki, yeah.
Kiyosaki, yeah. I know he talks about, and whether he's right or wrong, and again, you can give your 2 cents on it, but how he talks about, you know, the government are kind of not teaching money literacy in school times because it's not to their advantage. They want a, in quote, dumb kind of society that aren't kind of making money, aren't investing kind of in themselves. Do you think that there is value into obviously bringing this into high school and teaching kids about tax systems and money literacy and investing and things in a way that actually helps them, not just to tick a box and say, yeah, they did accounting kind of in year 9 kind of thing? Like, is there value in that? And if so, kind of what would be the best thing to be teaching, you know, year 7s, 8s, 9s, 10s, you know, whatever it might be throughout high school?
Yeah, I think it definitely would. Although I would question, you know, if the students were anything like I was at high school, probably wouldn't have been that interested in learning lessons on budgeting and that sort of stuff. So I think that you probably would find that there would be some people that would get a lot out of it. There would be others that might get less out of it or nothing out of it. But I think it all helps because ultimately, like, getting good with money is a skill that everyone needs to learn. And I don't know, I love Robert Kiyosaki's early work. He's sort of gone off on a bit of a weird tangent with some of the recent stuff that he's done around his education and property and that sort of stuff. But his book, it actually is the book that got me into personal finance. That was the book that started me on the journey to becoming a financial advisor. Before that, I knew nothing about the world of money, didn't know anyone that worked in finance. And that book sparked an interest that got me reading and learning more and ultimately, to where I am today. So I think that there's a lot of merit in a lot of the things that he talks about, although I don't know that the government is really trying to keep us financially literate on purpose. I would say that maybe they just don't know how to actually fix the problem, because ultimately for the government, if the country is wealthier, if everyone was wealthier, people would be paying more tax and then the country would be richer. So it's actually to their advantage. I would just say that there's probably some sort of bureaucracy / incompetence that's stopping them from actually, you know, making that happen. But in terms of where to start, I think that the really basic building blocks, there's probably three. There's saving and then investing. And over the top of those two, and in relation to a lot of other things as well, is building your habits around money, habits and behaviors. And I think you sort of touched on the crossover health and well-being. And I think we started about 2 years ago, we started doing a lot of work with professional athletes through the NRL. We started doing their financial literacy and well-being contract for all the professional male and female NRL players. And through that work and shaping up the content for that program, spent a lot of time thinking about the crossovers between health, sport, and money. And One of the things that came to mind is the fact that when you look at an elite athlete on the sporting field or, you know, in the arena or whatever, they make it look almost effortless. Like you look at them and they're just like, you look at a footy player and they pass the ball, they're, you know, ducking and weaving, and they make it look so easy. And what you don't see though, is you don't see the decades of practice that have put them in that position. And I think it's very similar when it comes to money, that people look at someone that's financially successful and they're like, oh, that makes it so easy. And they also think that they need to be able to do all of that to be good with money. But you don't need to know, like if you think about being super financially successful, you're going to know heaps about investing, tax rules, structuring, like a whole bunch of different tactics and strategies. But you don't need to know all of that right now. All you need to know now to be better with your money is enough to take the next step. And then you take that step and you learn some things and then you build your skills a bit around money. And then you need to figure out what the next step is and what you need to do to take that step. And then before you know it, it's like, you know, we talk about compounding of investing, but it's compounding of your habit building. And I think that you keep that momentum going. And then before you know it, you look back and then you've come a long way. And I think that if there was a way that you could drill that into people to get them started on that path sooner, then they're going to start figuring out, there's no one size fits all approach, but they're going to start figuring out, you know, what that step is for them, what they need to be doing, and start building their money muscle. That's a skill and a muscle that's then going to serve them for the years ahead.
I know you said it a couple of times today, and we kind of like, you know, this can be a bit boring and a bit dry kind of stuff, and going over what seems like the fundamentals and the basics. And then, you know, I asked the question, you know, should we start teaching this to kids? And you go, well, I remember when I was a kid, the last thing I wanted to hear was, you know, an economics teacher talking to me about that. But I kind of think back to a class I did in my first year of my undergraduate in exercise science, and it was a human growth and development kind of subject. And it was all about how kids learn certain tasks and how that then forms into more gross tasks later on in life. And so the simple act of throwing a tennis ball then lends to how you then serve a tennis racket and different things like that. And I remember sitting in that class and going, this is the most boring piece of shit I have ever listened to. I barely passed that class. But I say that because 10 years down the line, I'm sitting there working with an 11-year-old superstar tennis player that, you know, is going to do great things. And it just all came back to life. Now, even though I didn't really pay any attention to it in the class, and I don't really kind of have much recollection of what was taught, and I barely passed that class, it's amazing kind of what gets retained and what then comes out later in life, even though. Mm. And so, I say that to you in that, yes, these things can be boring. And yes, I think, you know, teaching kids is a really important kind of thing, even if they're not kind of paying attention to you at the moment. But I think kind of drilling in this stuff is just so important, be it financial literacy, be it health literacy. And it's why I keep banging down the word of consistency and kind of staying on task and finding those fundamentals. And, you know, is there something that can even drill into kind of, I mean, I've got two young daughters, and I think you're the same, you've got two young kids yourself. And like, is there something we can kind of drill into kids that, you know, they're going to just roll their eyes at you, kind of, hey, whatever, dad, shut up. I don't know, I did it to my father as well. But is there something that can kind of just, to kids, like I know I've already asked you kind of in high school, but just to keep drilling down that fact, is not the idea of you can't teach an old dog new tricks kind of thing, but kind of talking to someone who's 45, again, not that it's too late, but God, I wish you kind of had started 20, 30 years ago. Like, where do parents kind of really start kind of helping out their kids and kind of teaching, you know, the skills of saving or the skills of even investing to kind of help them out, even if they're just going to roll your eyes at you?
Well, I think like you were saying that your dad did to you, I think drilling in that if kids could understand the power of compounding and what that actually means for, you know, making their lives easier in the future, then I think that goes a long way. Thankfully, these days, the technology is getting better and there's more and more tools out there. There's a number of kids-specific investing platforms now, and some of them, and it's not like my daughters are 2 and 4, almost 4, so they're probably a little young to really grasp that. But as kids get a little bit older, giving them some exposure to investments and markets and how that works, and also just understanding how money compounds over time, if kids could know that, then they would and as long as they're a little bit sensible, at least, that they would realize that the sooner they start, the less they have to do to end up in the position that they want to be in, because that's the reality. Like, I think everyone's got a different version of financial success for them, a different lifestyle that they want to live. But ultimately, financial success is that you own the house that you live in and you're happy with that house, and you've got enough money coming into your bank account every week, month, or year from investments that allow you to live the lifestyle that you want without you having to work. That's essentially it. So that might be, you know, you own a $500,000 property and you've got $5,000 a month of investment income coming into your bank account every month. If that's you, you need to save a certain amount of money today. If you wait a week, a month, 6 months, a year, 5 years, you just need to save more and invest more to end up in the same position, or you just need to settle and compromise on that position, which is also not a good outcome. So if you could get our kids to understand that, I think that would go a really long way. The other thing, and I'm sure if you spoke to an actual money coach, and I've collaborated with a number of them that really get into the psychology side of money, and there's a ton of this, like there's behavioral finance and biases and heuristics that impact our, you know, how we manage our money, how we invest our money. But there's also a lot, and I'm not an expert in this particular area, but a lot about our relationship with money. And that does start at a really early age from my understanding. So I think if we could get our kids to have a better relationship with like earning, spending and saving money, that would also go a long way. Drilling it into, and there, again, I think they started with, there's like a piggy bank where you can have, you know, enjoy some of this. This is for charity. This is for saving or whatever. Start that practice early so that kids know that all the money they receive isn't there just to be spent, and you start building that habit and drilling it in early. That gives them, you know, a little bit of savings, that gives them the potential to invest, and then the compounding piece is the next stage beyond that. So I think, yeah, those are probably the two big things.
It's interesting you kind of bring up those points, in that I feel my girls are going through a very different lifestyle than what I did. And I sometimes worry about how that plays out long-term. Mm. By that, I mean in that we were never well off, but we were never, you know, never very poor. We were just middle-class kind of family growing up. I never felt like my parents were struggling to put food on the table or anything like that. But we never always had the shiny things and the new things that I know some of the people down the street had. And so I felt growing up that any money that I could bring in, and my parents always said, if you want something in life, go and work for it. We're not going to give you a handout. Whereas I would then say, oh, but Brad down the court, his parents just bought him the new bike or the new thing. It's like, well, if you want it, go and work for it and go into. So I took that work ethic into the rest of my life, because I watched my parents work day after day after day to provide a lifestyle for us. And I saw the fruits of what that did, that they would work really hard, and that we could have things and do things because they worked hard. And so I took that into my own life. And I sit there, and when you say that, you know, have these strategies to start saving, do these things. And yet my dad said, when I probably bought close to 7 or 8 cars in the space of 10 years, when I was like 18 to when I was, 30 years of age. And Dad goes, if you didn't buy all those things, you understand how wealthy you would be kind of right now if you'd invested. And I was like, yeah, but I also wouldn't have the stories and the things that I did and the places I went. And so I say all of that now, and that my girls, we live, again, I would say we're middle class. We're not super rich. We're not super poor. We have a nice lifestyle. But I now have kind of flipped the switch completely, and I try and just give everything I can to my girls. And it's like, you want something? I don't just arbitrarily just give it to them. They have to earn it in some way, shape, or form. But I don't have that message that my parents bring across of, if you want something, you have to go and earn this, because I just want to, I want to give everything to my girls. Like, I want them to have the life that, you know, I'd love them to kind of have. And I worry, does that kind of then play in that they then just become these entitled little brats kind of down the line that I kind of try and have that kind of balance. Like, where do I, and maybe other people are feeling this as well. Maybe you do as well yourself. I don't know, but how do kind of you find that balance that, you know, you just want to give your kids everything in life to kind of set them up, have the best things that they can and have a life that you only could have dreamt of, but then not turn them into entitled little brats where they just go, everything should just be handed to me. That's what it's always been like.
Yes. Yeah. Look, I don't know. I feel like that's probably outside of my area of expertise. I'll be able to tell you in about 14 years when my kids get a little bit older, but I do know that the relationship is, it does start when they're really young and then that evolves over time as well. So I don't know. I feel like probably your experience is broadly reflective of where we are as a country, in that our wealth levels are increasing and our standard of living is increasing such that that is now more possible than it was in our parents' generation and in generations before. What that means for work ethics and the brattiness of our kids in the future, I'm hoping that it's a good thing, but the jury's out on that one for me.
You say obviously standard of living's going up, and I mean you mentioned before, and I'd love to know the actual statistics of kind of where all those data points are of what the actual median kind of wage is, because I hear that number 92,000 being thrown around. I'm like, fuck, that's a big number. Like, I know how average is worked out, and it obviously takes every data point and then divides it between those numbers of data points. But I just sit there and kind of like, I don't understand how people are struggling in life if they've got a wage of $92,000, when if that's the average, you hear so many stories of like, you know, cost of living and all these kind of things going around. I'm like, if I had a wage of 92 grand, like, I wouldn't be complaining about cost of living kind of thing. That sounds like a really high number. Again, I say all of that to kind of like, what's going on in the world with regards to kind of inflation at the moment, cost of living, and kind of moving forward? Is it a place where, you know, as a thing, you know, food just continues to get more and more expensive, and yet we just expect wages to continue to go up? Like, how do you kind of see that future playing out for the country as you know, Australia is, but the world in general?
Yeah, well, the $92,000 income, that's the median income across Australia. That means that half of the population earn more than $92,000, half of the population earn less than $92,000. Now, that number is skewed heavily by the East Coast, and specifically Sydney and Melbourne, where the labor markets, I don't have the numbers to hand, but the average salary is much higher. The average across all income earners for a full-time worker in Australia is about $73,000. So the statistical average is a lower number, but that 92,000 is the median. Now, we're currently in the middle of an inflation crisis where they just released the most latest inflation data, just earlier today at the time of recording, and our inflation is currently sitting at 7% over the 12-month period. That means that on average, the cost of stuff has increased by 7% over that period. Wage growth, though, is not keeping up with inflation in the current environment. It's averaging around 5%. So what that means is that we're all getting effective pay cuts from the fact that stuff is increasing in value, and our salaries might be increasing, but they're not increasing by as much. I suppose that that's a bit of a trend where the government would like wages to continue to increase, because that means our productivity essentially increases over time. And look, there's a whole bunch of economic stuff which it is pretty dense and complicated, and there's a lot of different moving parts in this, but I'd say that if you look at it over the longer term, inflation is not as high as what it is today, and so our wages are sort of keep around, well, they're doing a little slightly better than what the increase in the cost of living actually is. But where there is an issue and a huge challenge, I think, for Aussies, and in particular younger Aussies, is the fact that property affordability is just decreasing year on year on year. And like, for you, you're over on the West Coast. property market. The property market has increased dramatically around the country in every single market, but in the areas around Perth, that property prices are much more reasonable, for lack of a better word, than what they are in Sydney and Melbourne. Now, the Sydney property market is the most expensive of markets, and the values are insane. Like, if you want to live within 10 kilometers of the Sydney CBD and you want a 3-bedroom property, you're talking about $2 million at least. And that's nothing flash at all, which seems pretty crazy when you consider that the benchmark of being rich, you know, up until the very, very recent past was you being a millionaire. Like, a millionaire is not enough. And a $92,000 salary in Sydney is not a lot to live on. Like, I put out a lot of client stories on our socials and unpack, and the people that work with us, they do have an income that's much higher than the average income. And you look at it, someone that earns a $200,000 income and go, wow, they're crushing it. But when you actually then look at what are the expenses, like if they're living and they want to live somewhere where they don't have an hour long commute to the city, and then they've got daycare costs on top of that and housing costs, and they might have a young family and partners working in a part-time capacity or maybe on maternity leave or something like that. And you start looking at the numbers and go, where are the opportunities to save here? And there's not a ton left over. Like, there's always an opportunity to save more, but it particularly on the East Coast in Sydney and Melbourne, these are expensive places to live, particularly because of housing costs as the main thing, but then also all of the, you know, daycare costs in particular, and costs related to kids as well. So I think that means that people have got less money left over. And then, we've got this, everyone ultimately wants to, or sort of needs to, have a roof over their head. So you've got this big question mark around your own home. And then, if you're thinking about being successful with your money, you've not only got to be able to buy your home, but then you've got to pay it off and build actual investments outside of your home, which are really what your actual wealth is. Because I see a lot of people go wrong in this, that while it is important and you need to have a roof over your head, your home is not really something that gives you any financial return until you sell it. And if you assume that you always need somewhere to live, like, the only way that you're actually extracting any money out of your home is if you downsize or you sell your property and move to a cheaper property at some point in the future. So that means that if you're taking out a $2 million mortgage, you've got to be able to save $2 million, which is obviously very challenging. And then you've got to also do your wealth building completely in addition to that. So you got to be mindful of that, I think, if you're setting up your strategy. And while I fully recognize that your home is a financial asset, I think you've got to almost look at it a bit more like an expense than an investment, to make sure that you can afford that expense and still be able to do the other things and make the progress that you want financially. So I see that as probably a major challenge for people looking to build wealth today, and particularly people that are earlier on in that journey that aren't already deeply into the property market, or, you know, haven't been able to benefit from buying property when affordability wasn't as bad as what it is today. Now, thankfully, the government are coming out with some initiatives that are helping to make it easier, though I think they've certainly got a lot more work to do there. But I think that's probably the biggest challenge. And overall, our wealth levels are good. Like, I think until the recent property slump, we were for a short period the wealthiest country in the world when you look at average wealth levels per capita, which is obviously a great position to be in. A lot of that wealth is tied up in the property market though as well. So on one hand, it's good to see that going, but, you know, in line with what I was just talking about affordability, it's sort of a bit of a double-edged sword there as well. But look, it's no doubt that I think people are doing it tough at the moment. We've got a lot of property, a lot of debt, higher average mortgages than ever before. And with 10 consecutive interest rate rises, it means that those costs are going up. And I think there are some people that are really struggling, and you know, don't really have any money left over and trying to make things work. But then there are also people that have been used to being in a really comfortable position for the last little while, and they are seeing their savings capacity eroded by this, the increase in interest rates and the cost of living. And I think they're a bit shell-shocked, and also to your earlier comments, like afraid of making a mistake or doing something. So they think that the safest thing that they can do is just to do nothing. You know, hold the money in the savings account, park it in their offset account, which is a really understandable reaction given that interest rates are where they are today. But to the earlier comments, like when you do that, doing nothing has risk attached to it as well. And it's the risk that you don't see today necessarily. But, you know, if you miss out on these periods, like what we're seeing at the moment, everyone's talking about how the world's going to end, but then share market is kicking off again, property market's starting to turn around. And the reality is that a lot of the best periods in markets happen either while the markets are going down or at the very end of a market downturn and at the start of the upswing. But if everyone's paralyzed with fear and sitting on their hands doing nothing, thinking that they're being safe and being smart, they probably miss out on those times that are the ones where you can really accelerate your momentum and around your wealth building. I was looking at these really interesting stats the other day. It was put out by Perla, the investment app platform. And they said that if you had $10,000 invested in the biggest companies in the US over the last 30 years, your $10,000 would grow to be worth, if you'd done that, it would be worth $208,000 today, which is a great, obviously, upside. But if you'd missed the 30 best days in markets over that 30-year period, your $10,000 would only be worth $36,000 today. The interesting part of that was, though, that half of those 30 best days happened when the markets were going down. So if you're not investing while the markets are going down, you're missing out on that. And then I think it was like another a quarter of the days that happened right at the start of a market rally after a downturn as well. So people think, like I said, that they think that they're playing it safe by not doing anything, but sometimes that can be the most risky thing that you do as well. While there are those challenges out there, I think if you're smart with your strategy and your approach and you take action and do that consistently, you let compound, you know, Einstein called compounding the eighth wonder of the world, and for good reason, I think. So you just need to keep doing stuff, even though it is hard. I think the alternatives to doing something is doing nothing, and that's never going to get you where you want to be.
That's exactly where my mind goes when I talk about the parallels between wealth and health, in that everyone has those days where the boss is yelling at them, they had a shit day at work, kids are running up the wall, and the last thing you want to do is go to the gym or cook that home-cooked meal, or the world is just ending around you. The last thing you want to do is actually take action to improve your health. But it's in those moments that if you just do something, even if it's not the big investment or the big thing that you always do, something is going to be better than just, you know what, I'm bunkering down. I'm just going to do nothing today because I just can't even fathom that. And it's the same. And I remember hearing that similar stat with regards to, you know, if you'd missed those 30 days, I think it was in Tony Robbins' Mastering Money book or one of those. I remember hearing him say something very similar that, you know, just investing daily, weekly, monthly, however it is, doing that and time again and leaving your money in there, not having that, oh shit, the world's ending type moment. I got to take this all out and think I'll save it now and then get back in when it's going good again. It's just being in there the whole time and continually putting in over and over and over is where the magic starts to happen in time. And I think you mentioned it at the beginning that I invest heavily myself as well, both my wife and have in index funds over the last kind of 15 years. And it's just been that repetitiveness of kind of just in. And when I see 2008 happen, the GFC, and then I see COVID happen and all these things just plummet. And of course, I don't turn on the news anymore and I haven't for a couple of years, and it's been the best thing for my mental health ever. But you no doubt hear it in conversations at school and things like that. It's just like, oh, have you heard what the market's doing today? And it's like, I pay zero attention to it because I could care less, because I'm not selling, I'm going to continue putting in, and it'll cost average itself out over long enough anyway. And to your point, what you're saying, if you're putting it in time and time and time again, that upturn in 20, 30 years time is going to be there. Unless, as you said, if it all goes to zero and it all goes to shit, I got far bigger problems than what my portfolio is doing anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that like what a lot of people see when markets are crashing and they start freaking out, worrying if they should sell. For me and for our clients, I'm going, great, that's an opportunity. Like no one likes to see the value of their shares going down. Like I don't enjoy that either, but I know that I'm a net investor. I know that I've got years. I'm going to be investing for years, like investing more. I'm not living off the income. So I'm just going, what extra money can I scratch up to actually put into the markets now and pick up those good investments at a discount? And I think, you know, a good investment 6 months ago is going to be a good investment today. You know, if the market's down, that's just a bigger opportunity.
To that point, I mean, I hear that comment all the time. And like, you know, the thing I've heard too many times over the last kind of 6 months is like, more millionaires will be now kind of produced in this next, you know, 2 years because of this huge opportunity everyone has. The flip to that is, and you've kind of highlighted, is that people are doing it tough at the moment. You know, people are like, you know, interest rates are going up. I used to have an extra $1,000 in my, you know, ability to spend or invest or whatever it is each month, but now that's been eroded by my mortgage repayments have gone up by $1,000. Like, cool, it's all good and all. So these are a great investment opportunities, and it's a great time to be getting in when these downturns are happening. But if people are kind of struggling and going, well, I don't have any money spare, like looking over, where's the best place for people to kind of look to in their kind of budget as it is to start, you know what? No, there's somewhere we could pull on. This is like, where's those places that you kind of seen work with your own clients, but people can also take on action today that I can draw on these little things and make life feel a little bit less stressful and start or continue to, I guess, invest and make sure that my future's still looking bright and furry down the line.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think that, I don't want to take away from anyone that's struggling at the moment, which is, you know, pretty much everyone, or struggling to come to terms at least with our new reality. But I think, you know, a little bit of tough love that we have been really fortunate that for a long time we've been spoiled with these ultra low interest rates, and meaning that our costs have been incredibly low around things like property through the last little bit, plus all the government, you know, pumping the economy with all the free money and stimulus and stuff. So we've sort of got, it's like the... it's like Parkinson's law when it comes to your health and dieting. Like, we consume what we have available. So we've got over the last few years, we've gotten used to the mortgage payments only being $1,500 a month or $3,000 a month or whatever that number is. And then we sort of tend to consume a lot of what's left over. And we think, you know, people save $1,000 a month. It's amazing. Doesn't matter what your income is, like people with this huge range of incomes and everyone's saving $1,000 a month because they go, okay, well, that's me doing enough, not like what could I actually do, and basing it off that. But I'll just put that out there as a general comment, because I think that, and it's a challenge, because if you're not necessarily financially minded and perhaps you bought your first property during the most recent run, then you maybe haven't seen an environment where interest rates are as high as what they are, and didn't know how to plan for that potential outcome before you got in. But most people should have, like, when you buy, particularly if there's one thing I can give to people that are listening in, like, if you're buying property, take the time to really understand what the numbers look like for your situation, not just today, but, you know, in 6 months' time, a year's time, 5 years' time. Think about the things that might change in your lifestyle, particularly if you're younger and you're planning to have a family, or you're in the middle of, you know, growing a family or whatever. These are things that have a significant impact on your financial position, maternity leave, working in a part-time capacity, childcare, which is more expensive than most private schools out there across the country as well. These are big chunky costs that could mean that while the property that you're thinking about buying might make a ton of sense for you today, when you actually look a little bit into the future, you realize that things aren't adding up. And I think that, again, not to take away from anyone that's struggling at the moment, but we probably collectively should be better at looking ahead and thinking about, well, what could change, and how do we prepare ourselves to make sure that we can do that in a way that's not as uncomfortable as what a lot of people are feeling today. But when it comes to like practically looking at your costs, the reality is that there's only so many types of expenses that people have. So there are four main types, which is your fixed costs. That's your rent, bills, the boring stuff, the regular predictable things, easy to predict, easy to automate. With those sorts of expenses, there's a couple of things you can do. One, for things like utilities and insurances, do your comparisons online. There's a bunch of really helpful sites out there where you can compare on your utility providers, you can compare on your insurance providers. These are highly competitive markets where a lot of companies are competing for new business. So there's an opportunity to do some saving there. Also, looking at your fixed costs, it's really easy for things to creep into our spending that we're really not using that much, or that we're not really getting that much happiness, enjoyment, or fulfillment out of. These days, it's so easy to set up the subscription for something and it's on some sort of auto payment function that you don't have to think too much about it. And it's amazing when we get people to do a budget, they think of some things and go, oh, actually, no, I'm not using that thing. I can cut that out. But once we do the budget, the next step for us is helping people set up different bank accounts. And one of them is a bills account where you put in just enough money to cover all the bills and then switch the payments to come over from there, so that it just gets paid without you having to think about it. When people do that, they realize that, oh, there was actually another seven things that I'd forgotten about. And they might be small things, but those small things add up. So really making sure that you're not paying for something that you're not using as a first step is something that can save you a bit of money there as well. The second, walking around money. So meals, entertainment, clothes, shoes, those sorts of things. Now there's some necessities in there, particularly shopping, like you got to feed yourself, and then medical expenses as well. But with like medical expenses is a bit of an exception, that when stuff happens, you basically generally just need to incur those costs and make the rest of the stuff balance. But when it comes to food, you can spend $50 or $500 on a meal like that. That's a choice. And so that's generally a pretty big area where you want to just be really mindful of what you're spending and make sure that you're working within your budget or spending plan. What I do for myself personally, and what we do with a lot of our clients as well, is I have a separate account for my spending money. In fact, we got one that we, a joint account with my wife that we have for the household, put a certain amount of money in there that covers shopping and, you know, odds and ends for the house during the week. And I have my own account, but essentially ring fencing that money from the rest of your spending and not spending it on a credit card and not spending it from an offset that's got 5,000, 10,000, you know, a large amount of money in there, forces you to make conscious spending choices around how you're spending it. Like I know when I'm tapping I still got Tap and Pay on my phone for that account, but I know that I need to know how much money is in there, and there's never that much money in there. So it forces me to shift my habits and behaviors around how I spend my money on a day-to-day basis. So for a lot of people, that's one of the categories are where they spend the most amount of money relative to their overall allocation. So I think that that's an important one to keep a handle on as well. The next one is debt. So debt payments, everyone's least favorite category. But I think when it comes to debt, sometimes you're limited in what you can do there. But once again, the markets for mortgages and for any other sort of debt products, personal loans, car loans, those sorts of things, are highly competitive. So looking at what's available in the marketplace and what you can do to save. If you haven't looked at your mortgage, like if you haven't formally reviewed your mortgage in the last 18 months, great opportunity to save. I was actually just doing a post this morning that about the loyalty tax that banks charge, that unfortunately, and this is definitely not something that's right, but banks charge more to people that have been with them for a long time than for new customers, because they price their new product sharply to attract new people in. And then once they get you in, I don't know, for some reason, they just sort of, the products get less and less competitive. So average mortgage size in Australia is $750,000. The difference between the average variable mortgage interest rate and the lowest mortgage variable interest rate that's available out there today is 0.91%. I was just looking at it this morning. on a $750,000 loan, that's like $7,000 a year in interest costs. And often you can get for, and this is what the post is about, that if you can find a product out there that matches the product that you've existing, that you've got in place at the moment, so like it's an owner-occupier mortgage, which is a variable interest rate, often if you call the banks, they'll just match the rates like quickly without you having to muck around with any paperwork or anything like that, as long as you can be really specific in your, you basically tell them that you're going to leave and tell them what you're going to leave to go to. And a lot of cases, they'll just match it because they do know that it's going to cost them more to get someone else in you than it is to keep you there as well. So that can be a really big one if that lines up for you. Also with other products, if you've got credit cards where you're paying a bunch of interest, looking at balance transfer credit cards or debt consolidation loans that have lower interest rates, need to be very, very careful if you go down that path that you don't fall into the debt trap and end up racking up multiple debts around that. But if you're cutting your interest costs, every dollar you save there is another dollar that you can use to pay down your debt faster as well. And then the fourth area is what I'd call your short-term savings. So short savings to spend, essentially, your lifestyle bucket. So, travel, weekends away, new stuff for the house and those sorts of things. For someone that's struggling, they're probably allocating less money to that bucket, but I think that is an important one. And if you're just living the way that you live, 12 months ago, that you might want to be looking at what money is going there. And once again, just prioritizing. And I think that's the thing across all of those buckets, that everyone's priorities are different. And this is why if a journalist asks me and says, how much should I be saving, or how much should I spend on housing, or how much should I spend on my day-to-day? There's no one right answer for that, because the right answer depends on you. But you want to make sure that any money that you are spending, that you are getting maximum, that it's the most important spending to you, because everyone's got priorities and everyone's priorities are different. Where you live, how much you spend for rent, how much you spend on your pocket money or entertaining yourself on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis. And your saving is a priority as well. So you want to really just look and go, okay, well, am I prioritizing the things that are the highest priority? Or am I just doing what I've done in the past and actually I'm prioritizing things that are not as important to me as some other things that I want as well? Because when you take that conscious prioritization, you generally make different decisions and often better decisions.
I want you to kind of peer into a crystal ball for a moment. And I'm sure you've been asked this question 100 times, if not more. What does the kind of next 6 to 18 months kind of look like for, again, the world around us, but specifically for Australia, where we're sitting in now? Are interest rates continue to go up? Is there maybe one or two left? Are they going to go down? What's the kind of market with regards to interest and inflation kind of looking like? Do you think your own kind of personal hunch, what are you thinking over the next 6 to 18 months?
Well, I'm an optimist, so I'd like to think that we've seen the end of the interest rate increases, but I think that the RBA has shown that they are really committed to making sure that they do squash inflation, or at least start getting it back to where they want it to be. I think, though, that it's probably worth noting that the RBA and the government do not want interest rates to be as high as what they are right now. They would be much happier if interest rates were lower. And so I think that as soon as the data justifies them reducing interest rates, then I think they'll be very happy to do that. Now, what I think I sort of don't know if I really know what I think will happen. It's a good question. Like I said, it's even like today they just released the latest round of inflation data. I think if they don't raise the interest rates in May, I don't know when you intend to release this podcast, but may happen, before or after this goes out. But I think if they don't increase them in May, I think it's very likely that we've seen the end of the interest rate increases. So because the inflation data is showing us that inflation is now going down. We just had our lowest quarterly read of inflation that we've seen since inflation started kicking up. And importantly, the what's called underlying inflation is reducing, and it's reduced more than what they were expecting it to reduce by. So yeah, I think that's my call, that if they do see a pause, then I think that hopefully they'll stop. And if things get really bad, like in the economy, I think that they will start dropping rates as quickly as possible. So the US is a big question mark and what actually happens over there, because they are the biggest investment market in the world and, you know, one of the biggest economies in the world as well. So the how bad things get, and I think things are going to get a bit worse in the States, will really play through to what happens in Australia. It's a really strange environment that we're in, and it's an environment that has that obviously there's always, well, obviously, maybe not obviously, but there's always a lot of factors that influence what happens in the economy. But at the moment, we've got some really conflicting factors in place where we've got, where we've seen interest rates really high, but then unemployment is still really, really low. Like I think the RBA were expecting unemployment to increase more than what it has at the moment, and business confidence is still high. Property sentiment is now starting to turn around positive, but we've got these high interest rates. So that combined with the fact that the government has pumped in all of this money into the economy with stimulus through COVID, and the fact that we've seen the RBA getting involved in financial markets, and particularly the US government has been flooding their markets with all these bond buying programs. These are things that are non-traditional policies implemented by the central banks and the governments, which means that there's no clear playbook for what they've done there. In history, what happened up until the GFC, what happened was that things started going well, and then, you know, the markets and the economy got quite hot, investment markets started going up, and then there's a market correction, and the government and the economy goes into recession, the share market goes down, the property market goes down, and you have to wait for a few years, and then things start going back up again. And that cycle just repeated itself for, you know, 150 years in Australia. But in 2008, because of the severity of what happened with financial markets, and specifically around all of the bundled up mortgage products that were manufactured around that time, the government stepped in and pumped a bunch of stimulus into the economy. That hadn't really been done before in that way. Now, in the 2008 crisis, the government put in about $50 billion in stimulus. I think what they realized when they did that was that all they have to do is spend a bunch of taxpayers' money that they may or may not have. At the time, we had a surplus, so it was like a lot of money that we did actually have. But then they get to give people money and look like legends and massively increase their chances of getting reelected and not deal with any short-term pain. So when the COVID crisis happened, I think they put in $500 billion the last time I looked at the number, which is 10 times the amount. And once again, like there was basically money raining down on everyone, ultra low interest rates. And I think they can't keep doing that forever. Like it's a thing that they got to pay the piper at some point. So how that actually happened, I don't know. There's so much, you know, so many conflicting opinions out there. But I think the overlying message is that we haven't seen what we're seeing now before, so it's hard to say that, you know, exactly what will happen. I get that not wanting to take the medicine and cop a recession and, you know, sit with markets being down for a few years is not good. But I can't help but wonder if that's what it probably needs to happen for stuff to be sort of normal as well. So I get that that's not as clear a prediction as maybe you were looking for with that one. But
and it's a valid point that you say, because I ask it because I never want bad things to happen to people, of course, and I don't think anyone does. And as you said, no one wants to go through a recession. They're not fun things to do. And that said, I think anyone who's around my kind of, I mean, I just turned 40. There's never, we've gone through a good long period of nothing really going wrong in the world. Yeah, there's been a couple of things going on, like, you know, the dot-com bust and then the GFC. Like, yes, but like if we kind of compare them to, you know, the Great Depression and all those kind of things, like, yes, it's been a pretty good time of it. And I know my grandfather and my parents as well, I was like, oh, if you had known how difficult it was back then. Like, yeah. I get those kind of comments. And so I say all of that because there's a part of me that kind of weirdly wants to go through a bad time. Like, I kind of want to experience that myself and think, how will I deal with it? Because, I mean, again, I started my business in 2006 and the GFC happened after it. And I remember my parents and I remember people around me going, and I'm in health, and health is a very discretionary type spend. People go, well, yes, do I need an exercise physiologist or a personal trainer at the moment? That's $100 a session. Geez, I could really do with $100 a week right now. And I understand that, but my business survived and I went through and I was like, geez, if that is bad as it gets, this is not too bad. Like, it's pretty easy running a business kind of thing. And yes, I've had difficult times, don't get me wrong, but like, it's been a pretty easy time of it over the last kind of 30 or 40 years. And so I don't know, there is a part of me that's almost kind of, how would I go if kind of shit really did hit the fan? How would we survive? What would we do? How would we go through it? But then there's the other side of me that goes, I kind of like my cushy life. It's kind of quite nice. So yeah, I mean, to your point, is like, did you answer your question? Like, I don't know. It's an interesting time, as you say, in the world at the moment. And I don't know, there's a part of me that goes, I think we could all do with learning a bit of a lesson at the moment. And as you said, kind of, you know, it's not always sunshine and roses, and we do have to kind of pull back here and change things up here. And maybe you do have to, you know, do that two steps back to go one step forward. Like, maybe it is kind of just take your medicine and kind of sit low and not kind of just have this lavish life kind of all the time kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it will. And I think that will come. I think it has to. I think it's ridiculous to think that we're just going to keep having these like short, you know, short term, like a minor market correction, and then things go back to great guns again. I don't think that time is going to be right now. Like, I know that a lot of people talking these banking issues and stuff happening in the US, and also, you know, prior to the last couple of months with what was happening in the property market in Australia. But I think that probably the property market is showing signs of recovery. I think Westpac have just called the bottom of the property market. The four biggest players in property space have called that as well. And I don't know if the recovery will be as sharp as it was the last time there was a downturn, but I think it has a good chance to be. And I think a lot of people are going to get left behind in the property market, listening to a lot of the fear talk out there where people are saying, you know, the market's going to crash, there's all these fixed interest rates, which is all entirely true. But it's so multifaceted in terms of all of the things that are playing there that I think a lot of people don't realize that now is going to be the best opportunity that they get to get into the property market or make their next property move, if that's on the roadmap for them and if they can do it in a way where their risk is managed. I think that the share market will continue to go a little bit sideways, but we'll see some upward trends there. And I think that will probably continue for a bit, but I think probably that correction is coming at some point, but probably, you know, in the end of the next market cycle.
I've held your time for a while today, Matt, and I really appreciate everything you've given. I always love finishing off podcasts, though, with a bit of a nugget that people can take away with them, like some sort of really small action that kind of makes a meaningful impact on their life, whether it makes a meaningful impact tomorrow or it's in the case of finances and health, usually kind of down the line. If for say, you know, as I said, people can always try and find and scrimp and save and kind of find those parts where discretionaries maybe kind of be able to pull back or kind of redivert things and whatnot. If someone has $50 to $100 a week extra that they find because this podcast has helped them look into their expenses and things, you know what? Yeah, I can spare $100 a week. I can find that, which I think most people probably could if they were really honest with what's going on, at least $50 to $100 a week. Where would you put that $50 to $100 a week?
Well, look, I'll take that like half a step further or maybe half a step backwards at the same time and say that I think that the nugget would be that if you don't already have a regular investment plan, if you're not investing every single week at the moment, that should be what you do. Now, these days with micro investing platforms, you can invest as little with some of them as one single cent, but most of them have a regular minimum of like $5. Everyone should be able to find $5. I don't care what your situation is. Like, I know that that's hard, but that's like $5 is $5. And I guarantee, and I wrote about this in my book, that if you start investing $5 a week today, within 3 months, you'll be investing more than $5 a week. And even if things are super tight and you still are investing $5 a week in 3 months' time, you're building your knowledge around investing that'll give you more confidence into the future. Now, again, this is not financial advice, but what I would do is pick an index fund because I know that they're rock solid and tried and tested, and you can sleep like a baby at night knowing that your money is doing what they were doing. Again, there's a ton of platforms out there that allow you to do that. Automatic investment plan. So you've got your default as you investing regularly. You don't have to actually do anything. You can just link it up to your bank account. You can do it all on your phone. You can do it all within 15 minutes on your phone. And then immediately you're an investor. There's only 54% of Australians don't have any investments outside of their superannuation or their own home if they're a homeowner. So if you do that, if you're not already investing and you do that today, you're already in the top 50% of the population when it comes to investing. And you're going to have to do this at some point. So do it now and then get the compounding happening for you now. But more importantly, start building the muscle now, because when you start doing that, you learn, you start paying attention, then you go, well, maybe I could increase that to $6, maybe $8, maybe $12. And before you know it, you're doing the $50 or $100 that you mentioned. Like if you can do $50 or $100, don't start with $5, start with $50 or $100. But if you're not doing anything, then do something. It's a million times better than doing nothing.
I'll go back to Tony Robbins and say, I remember in his book, he said, if the government came in tomorrow, like it's all good and all to say, you know, start saving 20% of your income, and people just go, fuck, I don't have 20% to spare. What do you mean? He said, If the government came in tomorrow and all of a sudden just added 20% tax on top of everyone's things and you had no if, buts, whens, or what, you would have to find a way. And so
that's right.
I say that with a bit of tough love kind of behind it, in that, yeah, whether it's five, whether it's 50, whether it's 100, whatever it might be, I mean, You just have to kind of start and just kind of get into it. And again, those parallels between health and wealth, like just start doing something, however small it would be. And you said exactly right. If you start $5 today down the line, or if you start 5 minutes walking around the block down the line, That'll be 10 minutes, that'll be 20 minutes, that'll be an hour. It just starts to build that muscle. And so I appreciate that insight, mate, and I appreciate you sharing everything you have with us today.
Oh, mate, happy to help. It's it's good to be on the other end of the microphone, as I was saying at the start.
I guess for everyone trying to, find more knowledge around this and kind of want, you know, maybe heard you speak today and kind of want to find you, I'll put it in the show notes and ask you for those after we've had a chat today. But just verbally, where can people find you? You spoke about a book. What's the book called? I give you this red carpet to please sprout yourself and kind of pinpoint where people can go.
Sure. Yeah. So you can look us up on, we're on most of the socials, TikTok, Ben Talks Money, Pivot Ben on Instagram. I probably should make those handles the same, but you can check those out. I just released my second book, Replace Your Salary by Investing. So that's basically wherever you get your books from, you can suss that out. That goes through a lot of the topics that we covered today. And as the name suggests, the book is the start to finish game plan to actually replace your salary investing. We also do a lot of regular live events, which are completely free, like webinar online events. So if you look up Ben Nash or Pivot Wealth on Eventbrite, you'll see our upcoming events. You can get behind one of those, check out and dive a little bit deeper, or on the Pivot Wealth website, which is pivotwealth.com.au.
Awesome, mate. As I said, I'll pin all those in the show notes below so people can find that out. But I always finish off my podcast though with a random question that's come from last week's guest. So if you don't mind me diving into that,
I'm a little bit nervous about this, but let's do it.
This one actually is I'm not going to say a bit more heavy than I have had, but it is a bit more detailed. So it'd be interesting to see where you go. Last week's guest asked, "What's the most important thing for you to experience before you die?"
Ooh. That is a tricky one. Big question. I want to say something travel related, but I'm not sure exactly what that is.
Have you got the travel bug? Are you someone that loves travel, been traveling?
Well, yeah, I used to travel a lot before having kids and before COVID sort of put a bit of a spanner on that. But we're getting back into it, finding our feet again. Now our kids are we just did our first decent overseas trip with them at Christmas, went over to Malaysia and the Philippines, which was quite fun, definitely challenging with a couple little kids and, maybe not as efficient an airline sort of system as what we've got here, although maybe as efficient, maybe more efficient given our recent experiences there. But maybe the Northern Lights. That's something that I've always wanted to see.
A good one.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's an answer to the question. I really appreciate that. And then to then forward that on, have you got a random question for next week's guest?
Well, I do. And I have to say to your last guest, it's probably a bit easier than that one as well. my question is, what is your spirit animal?
What is your spirit? Sorry, I'm just typing this out on here. Animal. That's an interesting one. Do you have a reason for asking that question? Is that something that you've thought about more of recent times, or something that you've looked into, or is it just popped into the head?
It's just one of the random questions that we throw at a new team member when they join, like, and we bring them along to their first team meeting to just get, I feel like it's a good one to get a bit of insight to someone's personality a little bit. So
I like it. Excellent. Yeah. Well, again, I really do appreciate your time today, and thank you for everything that you shared. And I said, hopefully people listening in have found some sort of gold nugget from it that can turn into actual virtual, real gold nuggets in their life. So I appreciate that, all of that, mate.
Oh, mate, it was a pleasure.
Awesome, guys. That's been another episode of the Let's Just Talk podcast. You know what to do. Share it, like it, subscribe, do all those things. I love you all. I'll talk to you next week. Bye.